different kinds of birds, what the possible reasons are, and what he has to say about what would be involved in trying to do something about the less desirable aspects of it. So over to you, thank you very much, off you go.
Thank you very much, it's a real pleasure to be here. How many of you are familiar with the RSPB already?
Most of you. We've heard of it.
Is that the extent of familiarity?
Now I'm a bit more than that.
You're a member. Great. So I suppose I should start just telling you a little bit about the RSPB. So we were set up about 100 years ago. I should know the exact date, but I don't. But initially, well, primarily a bird conservation organisation, although more recently we've shifted our focus to looking at all species, so not just birds. I mean, for many years we've effectively worked on multiple species because we have, you know, mammals, amphibians, reptiles occurring on our nature reserves. So we own about 250 nature reserves across the country. We're the largest nature conservation organisation in Europe, so we've about 1.1 million members, which is sort of bigger than all the political parties combined. So it's quite a substantial chunk of people. And we're also part of a global network of bird conservation organisations called BirdLife International, which is the largest network of conservation organisations worldwide. And so we work on a wide range of issues. We've got nature reserves, as I said, but we also work on influencing land management in the wider countryside, because lots of our birds, lots of our wildlife rely on more than just nature reserves. They occur across a range of habitats. We do a lot of work understanding the factors influencing bird numbers. So we have a conservation science department at our headquarters in central Bedfordshire. We do a lot of work with families, educating children, getting people excited about wildlife. We do a lot of work trying to influence government policies, environmental policies, which ultimately determine the fate of most of our wildlife. So it's quite a wide range of things that we do. And as I mentioned, we're part of this global alliance of conservation organisations. So today what I'm going to talk to you about is a project I was involved in when I was actually working at the BirdLife International headquarters, which is based in Cambridgeshire. So Cambridge is really a centre of excellence.
Can I ask where exactly it is based?
And the headquarters is based Sandy in Bedfordshire.
Sandy?
Yes. So Cambridge is really a centre of excellence when it comes to conservation organisations. It's sort of a global hub for more conservation organisations based in Cambridge, probably anywhere else in the world outside of possibly Washington. So it's a real hub for conservation action. As I said, I'm going to talk predominantly about a project I was involved in about 3 years ago, looking at, so I'm an environmental economist by training, which so I look at a wide range of issues, economic issues affecting how we manage our land and the policies we put in place to protect wildlife. And the project I was involved in looked at how much we would have to invest in saving threatened species across the world, because currently what we spend on conservation is pretty trivial compared to the threats that nature faces. So I'll start with providing an overview, a brief overview of the state of nature, mainly globally. I'm not going to focus too much on the UK, but I am going to focus a little bit on the UK. I'm talking about all species, not just birds. Talk about some of the threats that they face, some of the solutions, how much it will cost to actually implement what's required to halt the declines of global biodiversity, and whether or not it's worth it. So why should we invest in saving nature when there's so many other priorities we need to think about, whether it's the NHS or the education system? Why should we invest more in saving nature? So it's a bit gloomy, really, first part of the talk. So nature in the UK is most definitely in trouble. The most recent sort of assessment of how things are doing in the UK came out in 2013, the State of Nature Report, which looked at data from multiple, I think it was 25 conservation organisations across a range of taxa, so the most comprehensive assessment to date of how nature is doing in the UK. So it was amphibians, reptiles, birds, plants, lichens, you name it. And for the species for which data were available, 60% have declined over the last 60 years. So more than half our species are going down, and about half of those species are declining quite severely. And 1 in 10 are actually at risk of extinction within the UK. Specifically in terms of birds, the best estimates suggest we've lost about 44 million breeding birds, or 1 in 5 pairs, in the last 50 years. Along with over 90% of our wildflower meadows, for example, 90% of lowland heath. So quite, you know, habitats as well as species really declining. 75% of butterfly species in decline, for To give an example of a bird species, which I don't know how many of you have ever seen or heard a turtle dove.
Got one in my nature reserve.
Oh, lucky you.
Very lucky.
There are still one or two pairs breeding in Cambridgeshire, but they've declined by 95% since 1995, so absolutely massive decline of what was once a common farmland bird across the UK. And a real sort of real sign of summer. And hen harriers, one of our iconic birds of prey, are now down to one breeding pair in the UK, or in England, sorry. And only this week, another three birds were found shot dead. So persecution is for hen harriers.
I actually live fairly near to Feltwell Fen.
To where?
Feltwell Fen.
I don't know Feltwell Fen.
Well, it's just beside the River Little Ouse.
Okay.
And there is a nature reserve there where hen harriers are not infrequent.
In the winter, yes. So we get lots of hen harriers coming to winter in East Anglia. But as a breeding bird, they're incredibly rare. Well, only one pair bred successfully last year.
Okay.
And it's also worth mentioning, and this is something the RSPB works on, is that the UK are responsible for quite a few overseas territories, mostly oceanic islands, which together are actually in terms of biodiversity importance, completely outweigh what the UK has to offer in terms of endemic species, so species found nowhere else on the globe. About 90% of wildlife, threatened wildlife for which the UK is responsible occurs in the overseas territories, but actually very little awareness or conservation action in those areas. And in fact, we're responsible for more penguins than any other nation on the planet, which I quite like. And under our control, we should be looking after these birds. Globally, it's pretty grim as well. One third of amphibians, one quarter of mammals, and about one fifth of plants are threatened with global extinction, based on the best available data, and everything's tending to go down quite rapidly. So that's based on IUCN Red List criteria. Another way of looking at it is this is the Living Planet Index, which is something done by WWF, and we've lost about half our large vertebrate species. On average, vertebrate population, so anything that's not an invertebrate, so mammals, amphibians, birds, etc., have declined by about half since 1970, so less than two generations.
There is one issue which is, so to speak, a kind of reference background to everything you've been saying so far, which is essentially species abundance distributions. That for species of a given type of animal, whatever, there will be a moderate number of species which are quite abundant, and then a fairly long tail of different species which are in fact rare.
Very much so.
And given this very long tail of a large number of rare species, and being rare they are definitely at risk. It's so to speak intrinsic in the species distribution shape that a proportion of them, a substantial proportion of them, like maybe a third or a quarter or a fifth, are at threat of extinction because they are just
not,
so
not, not so, not so, because I will come on to talk about how you assess.
Right.
There's a set of very clear criteria against which you assess a species population, both on its size, its distribution, and its trend.
Yeah.
It's based on that, so a species, you know, many of these species have survived for hundreds of millions of years, so the idea that they're on the brink of extinction all the time is not really credible. But I will come on to talking about that. So some of the major threats to wildlife globally, I mean, there's sort of direct and indirect threats. Direct threats are things like habitat loss, habitat degradation, over-exploitations, whether that's hunting or overfishing, overhunting, etc. Invasive species, so non-native species, species that are not native to a particular country, actually being introduced into that country. And that's one of the major drivers of extinction, particularly on oceanic islands, where you have introduced predators like rats or cats, and native birds which are, and other animals which are not adapted to deal with that. So on a lot of Pacific islands you get ground nesting birds, for example, so they're very liable to attack by cats and rats who are ground predators. And then pollution, so various forms of pollution, but climate change, not necessarily a current threat to wildlife, but very much the major future threat going forward and compounding all other threats. But then you've got the indirect drivers. So ultimately, you know, these things, habitat destruction, degradation, etc., are driven by the human population, what we consume, what we choose to consume, how much we consume, how what we consume is produced, and how many of us are consuming. So people often talk about it as population, consumption, and technology as sort of a simple way of describing those things. I suppose, you know, world GDP has tripled since 1950, which is, you know, the fastest growth the world has ever seen. But at the same time, biodiversity has precipitously declined, and you know, they're obviously linked in more than one way. I will talk a bit more about threats in relation to birds a bit later, but that's just sort of a broad overview of the main categories of threats. So what is it that makes a species threatened? So I'm not going to go into too much detail on this, but when I talk about species at risk of extinction, it's based on the IUCN Red List, which is sort of widely recognised as kind of the benchmark against which risk of extinction is assessed. It basically consists of a set of hierarchical categories and then criteria against those categories. So ranging from least concern, so species that are just, you know, fine, they're doing okay, right up to critically endangered or, you know, extinct in some cases. And basically the way species are assessed, based on three main things: the size of the population, the size of its distribution or its range size, and the trends either in its population or its range. So if it's got a rapidly decreasing range or rapidly decreasing population. So for example, a species that's defined as critically endangered, there's a number of reasons it could be critically endangered. Usually it's either a population of less than 50 individuals, so that's not something that occurs naturally. Population that's declined by more than 90% in 10 years, so again that's something that's heading for extinction. Or a species that's found at less than 3 locations, and locations are defined in a particular way, but less than 3 locations, and a declining population of less than 250 along with that. So sort of quite a comprehensive set of criteria against which these species are assessed. Just to give a kind of a benchmark, so for critically endangered bird species, less than 50 individuals left. By contrast, we've got 4 million pairs of breeding blue tits in the UK, about 50 million across the UK, so it's quite a disparity between the two. So using the IUCN Red List, BirdLife International is the responsible body for assessing birds globally. There's about 10,000 species of birds around the world. About 1 in 8 are threatened with extinction. About 200 critically endangered, 400 endangered, and about 800 vulnerable. And another 1,000 classed as near threatened, which means they're almost thresholds for being listed as threatened with extinction. And things have really been going downhill for all those species over the last 50 years. The number of species listed as threatened has sort of precipitously increased over time. And these are sort of some of the major threats. They're not categorised the same way I described them earlier on, but what you can probably see from this is that agriculture is a major one. So basically the expansion of agriculture and the intensification of agriculture around the world. So more than half the land surface of the planet is now agriculture. So obviously that has driven habitat loss, habitat degradation, fragmentation of remaining habitats. So agriculture is a big one, invasive species quite a big one. Loss of forest habitat, partly driven through agriculture, so there's some relationship between these. A few other ones, residential and commercial development, not a major problem, certainly not in the developed world, but a problem in some developing countries where planning systems are pretty poorly developed. It's just an example of some of the problems we have at sea, which is mainly due to bycatch and fishing gear. So 17 of the world's 22 albatross species are threatened with extinction, and interestingly 16 of them breed on UK overseas territories, so quite a responsibility for the UK to do something for those fairly charismatic birds. It is going to get slightly less depressing. This is also to demonstrate that even common birds, what one would describe as common birds, are also declining. So the top panel shows the index of all common bird species in Europe compared to common farmland birds, which sort of again illustrates the issue with agriculture, that farmland birds have declined quite precipitously over the last 20-30 years. And the lower panel shows what's happening to our long-distance migrant species, which are being threatened right across their flyways.
Something happened to both kinds between 1980 and 1985.
Yes, almost certainly when EU legislation came in to protect. The Birds Directive came in during that period, which almost certainly led to that increase, which basically provided the first proper legislative protection for birds right across Europe. And yes, long distance migrants also do badly because they're threatened not just where they spend the summer but also where they spend the winter, so it's a double whammy for them. But it's not all bad news. Some birds have come back from the brink, so to speak, it's just a handful of them. About 45 bird species have actually improved in red list status over the last 30 years. That doesn't seem like very many. About 45 species have genuinely improved, so some have just moved from critically endangered to endangered, or from endangered to vulnerable. So small improvements, but improvements nevertheless. And this is a story which I find quite interesting, because it's a sort of shows really the challenges, but also the opportunities. So vultures are not particularly popular species necessarily. So this was a difficult sell, this one, but between 1990 and 2010, vultures, so three main vulture species found right across the Indian subcontinent, declined by about 99.9%, which you can see there's a log scale on the y-axis. So populations, what was once hundreds of millions of vultures across the Indian subcontinent, declined to less than 1,000 for these three species. So sort of a huge, massive change. They were once the most abundant bird of prey in the world, but sadly no longer. And the RSPB, with others, investigated the problem, collated a huge amount of scientific evidence to demonstrate what the problem was, and eventually convinced the Indian government. And it turned out to be the use of diclofenac, which is an anti-inflammatory, which you can buy for human use, but was increasingly being used by Indian cattle ranchers to treat their cattle for sort of inflammatory issues. And unfortunately, despite the fact that vultures' stomachs can tolerate virtually anything, they can deal with bones and blood and guts, they unfortunately can't deal with diclofenac and causes kidney failure almost immediately.
How is it getting from the cattle into the vultures?
Well, the vultures are carrion feeders, so they feed on dead carcasses. And
particularly dead calves?
Not dead calves, no, dead adults usually, because I mean in India they tend to leave the cattle out to die. So, yes, but thankfully, through a number of measures, so a ban and a captive breeding program, they have, for the first time, this is the latest data point we have, they have started to increase. But if you look at the log scale, you can see that they're still, you know, very much on the edge of extinction. It will take, you know, several hundred years for them, if ever, to get back to the numbers that they were at. So both a challenge but also a very positive story, I think. So that's hopefully some of the depressing stuff over. So how do we solve this problem? You know, you've got species declining all around the world. You need a global agreement, basically. And the Conventional Biological Diversity is that global agreement that came into force in 1993 with sort of, I think most nations on Earth have signed up to it at this point. There might be a handful of small ones that haven't. And its main objectives are the conservation of biodiversity and the sustainable use of biological diversity. So they're sort of two key objectives. And nothing really happened for the first couple of years. There was sort of lots of conferences, lots of talking shots, not a lot happening. They did agree finally, world governments finally agreed to a target in 2002 to achieve a significant reduction in the rate of biodiversity loss by 2010, which was quite an achievement to get so many governments to sign up to that. Unfortunately, the target wasn't achieved, and that sort of shows, this is a bit of a messy slide, but basically a whole range of indicators of how things were doing across the world. And things continued to decline, pressure continued to increase, but actually the response was starting to get going. Governments were designating more protected areas, they were putting in place laws to protect wildlife, so some positive things happening. And in the follow-on meeting of the CBD in 2010, they then agreed to an arguably even more ambitious plan, setting key targets up to 2020 for saving threatened species. However, what wasn't made clear at those meetings was how action to actually achieve those targets would be funded, which is one of the key issues that we're aware of, which is where the project I was involved in sort of came into this, which was funded actually by a Cambridge body, the Cambridge Conservation Initiative, to assess the costs of meeting the key, so although there were 20 targets, the key targets for the conservation sector related to protecting at least 17% of the global land area in protected areas or other suitably managed sites of particular importance for biodiversity. And then a more specific target focused on threatened species, which was aiming to prevent any more extinctions and improve the status of those species most in decline. And the challenge for this project was to work out how much it would cost to achieve those targets, so what would the financial investment need to be. And remember that this agreement came about right in the middle of the global financial crash, so you know, money was not flowing around. And the second question is how much we're actually spending currently, so what's the financing gap? What do we need governments and others to actually commit to delivering to achieve those targets? And we approached this using data on birds, so I was working for BirdLife International at the time, and data on birds is probably the best we have for any group of animals around the world, so they're often used as useful indicator species of how things are changing. But we use the data for birds to work out costs for all species, basically using a number of different formulae. So I'll talk about this in a little bit of detail, what we did with this project. I wasn't quite sure how to pitch this talk, so I'm going to go into some of the methods, but hopefully nothing too sort of technical or sort of dull. But if I am being boring, just let me know. But so for target 12, which was the aim of preventing future extinctions, preventing any further extinctions by 2020, and improving the status of those species most in need of conservation, we set as our objective for costing the actions required as improving the status of all threatened species by at least one IUCN red list category. So if I go back to this, so for example, this would be for all critically endangered species, for them to improve sufficiently in status, whether through population increases or range size increases, to no longer qualify as critically endangered, to instead qualify as endangered. So that was the sort of the one category improvement. Or for a species that's currently classified as vulnerable, for it to become no longer threatened or near threatened. So that's sort of the minimum requirement. So for each species, BirdLife already holds an awful lot of information on what's required, what the main threats are for each species. So we set targets for each species on the minimum improvements in their status that will be required to get them downlisted to a lower red list category. So for a species, for example, that's critically endangered because it had less than 50 individuals, for it to classify no longer as critically endangered, it would need to have a population of more than 50 individuals, basically, so it's quite straightforward. And for each species, we drew up a list of the key actions required, so whether that was sort of site protection, whether it was species management, so things like captive breeding, reintroductions, whether it was more research, more monitoring, so a range of actions required for each species. And then got in touch with experts, really, in the field, around the world, who work on these species. So I think we had species in probably nearly all countries of the world. I got experts, at least two or three experts per species, to estimate the costs required to downlist that species through achieving those conservation actions. So we didn't look at all threatened bird species. We looked at pretty much all critically endangered birds, about 20% of endangered and vulnerable birds. And experts estimated the costs for each species or for each action, kind of in a minimum and a maximum required, and also baseline expenditure, so what's currently being spent on their conservation, so we get an idea of what the funding gap might be. So that gave us information for a sample of bird species, but then obviously we needed to work out costs for all threatened birds. So we sort of developed a statistical kind of costing model, if you like, looking at a range of variables that are known to sort of influence, or were thought to influence costs for bird species. So some of them were quite obvious. Red list categories, so we wanted to know whether the extent of threat to a species, if you like, would determine the costs of actually saving it. The size of its range, so species with bigger ranges you'd expect to be more expensive to conserve because actions required over a larger area. Also island endemism, because island species tend to face a very specific set of threats. So we also looked at socioeconomic indicators because, in general, conservation is more expensive in rich countries because staff costs are more expensive, land costs are higher. So we also looked at sort of socioeconomic variables in all the range states of the relevant species. And unsurprisingly, found that indeed total costs for a species do depend on the size of its breeding range, do depend on how rich a country is, and a number of other factors. And using this model then really tried to come up with costs for all threatened bird species. It's probably don't need to go into this, but obviously bird species, some of the threatened species overlap, their distributions overlap to some extent. And so you don't want to double count costs for those that are overlapping. So we really did this through sort of a spatial analysis where we spread the costs for each species over its range using a GIS. Then overlaid those layers for each species and worked out a maximum species cost per cell, and then assumed that would cover the action required for all of the species occurring in that cell because it was the highest action or the highest cost action required. And then essentially we were able to come up with sort of a min and max, one min assuming that costs can be shared between species, and then sort of a max assuming the costs couldn't be shared between species, and all the actions would be required for each individual species. So this is just for threatened birds now. We came up with a cost required of between, well, approximately $1 billion a year over a decade to improve the status of all those species by approximately one red list category. And a median cost per species is about $850,000 a year, although there was quite a lot of variability around that. So critically endangered species tended to be actually cheaper despite the high level of threat, because they tend to be quite isolated in specific areas. And then we also looked at, the graph on the right sort of shows that red being critically endangered, orange being endangered, and yellow being vulnerable. And then for those species we looked at what's currently being spent on their conservation. And we came up with a median current expenditure per species of about $65,000 per year. So $65,000 per year compared with $850,000 per year. You can sort of see where the disparity lies. So taking a median across our sample of species is the gap. We found about...
Sorry, when you're ready.
Sure, yes.
Okay. Looking at the graph, the more endangered, basically, that's number of species. Yeah, but also the more endangered, the less it costs.
That's right, yeah.
But that is presumably related to the number of species and also the abundance per species, because more endangered means less abundant per species.
That's right, yeah.
And therefore, less wide distribution on the whole.
Yeah.
And therefore, as it were, a smaller target for your funding.
Potentially. I mean, it does depend on what the threats are.
Yeah, it would. But,
it does. I mean, you can see that, you know, that equally there's critically endangered species that cost more than all other species, but you can barely make them out on the graph. But yeah, so anyway, about 12% of the current funding is estimated to be sort of happening, if you like. And generally funding is inadequate for most species, so for about 50% of species, or for less than half of species, kind of their key needs are being met. And it's worth noting that's probably an overestimate of what's currently being spent, because in general the species we were able to get data on tended to be the ones where some minimal conservation action is actually happening on the ground. So you had people working on them, so we had experts we could contact. They would know what's currently happening, what more needs to happen. So probably an overestimate of what's currently being spent, but sort of we use it as our best guess. And that just gives you a sort of a look at the distribution of cost per kilometre per year across the world. But it's slightly difficult to interpret because obviously the costs in that will vary for a number of reasons, primarily actually due to the number of species occurring in an area. So sort of look at it like that. But it doesn't change that much whether or not you take into account overlapping costs between species. So it gives you an idea effectively where there are real hotspots of global bird diversity and also serious threats. We sort of tried
to think that, go back to the one before that, the sort of island areas like around Australia, Far East, seem to have high incidence of cost.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number. So as I said, this also reflects the number of species, the number of threatened species occurring there, obviously. And in general, islands tend to be quite diverse because they've often been isolated for quite a long time from continents, so they have lots of endemic species.
Yeah.
They also tend to be quite threatened, mainly due to introduced predators. So,
especially like Australia and New Zealand.
Australia and New Zealand, also parts of Southeast Asia, introduced predators, so rats, cats, snakes, mice, dogs in some cases, goats, none of which are native to those countries, tend to cause quite serious problems. And we'll come back and look at that later. So anyway, we also tried to sort of to check that these costs were reasonable by looking at how much had been spent on those species that had previously improved in status, of which there are 42, I think, or maybe 45. We got costs for about, well, just over half of those, and found a similar range of costs across species that have previously improved in status, which are shown in the kind of the empty black, versus our sort of modelled costs, which are in the grey. So similar range, but a slightly lower median for previous improvements in status. And we think the reason for that is predominantly because most of the species that have improved in status in the past have been island endemics, about three quarters of them. and so they've had very, very small ranges. In fact, most of the successes have been through rat eradication, so that's led to major improvements. So it's not entirely doesn't entirely sort of validate our results, but gives you a sense that they're probably, you know, a reasonable estimate. This is just one example of a species that's improved in status before, which actually isn't today, so invasive species, having made that point. Tiny little bird that occurs in southern Ecuador, and was thought extinct until I think the late 1990s, when somebody came across a small population of it in southern Ecuador. And the remaining areas of suitable habitat were quickly purchased because they were ready to be cleared for agriculture, and fenced to remove overgrazing from surrounding areas. A little bit of predator control in the area as well, because there are some problems with cats. Relatively small amount of money for those, 350,000 in total over 10 years, and their population increased from less than 50 to about 240 over that 10-year period. So not a stable species, still at high risk of extinction, but no longer at extremely high risk of extinction, but an example of an improvement in status through kind of well-targeted conservation action.
So just to pop back a bit, the effect of this success, is that the CRD1 versus the END1?
Yes, sorry. So sorry, D1 is one of the, it's called, I previously given this presentation to some conservation scientists. D1 is one of the criteria. So yeah. D1 relates to small population size. So if you're CRD1, it means you're critically endangered with a population less than 50. If you're END1, you're critically endangered with a population less than 250. So it's just one of the criteria.
So on that criterion, as a result of this intervention, it rose from below 50 up to
about 240. So it no longer qualified as critically endangered.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But there's ongoing costs to maintain fencing to keep predators out.
So that was the effect of the intervention.
Yes. Yeah. Well, one would assume so. So I know this is not a threatened species, but it was the best picture I could find in the RSPB's image library I just like badgers. They may well be threatened in parts of Southwest England quite soon. So. So we then tried to extrapolate to all threatened species, which was kind of a little bit of a back of the envelope calculation, I have to admit. But there was some information already available for other taxa on the costs of improving their conservation status, and we particularly relied on evidence from New Zealand, where they'd actually costed the actions required for all 600, or not for all 600, for 600 of their most threatened species: birds, mammals, amphibians, bats. And we found this ratio that median costs for birds were about four times higher than those for the other taxa. And then just used that basic relationship to multiply up the figures we had for threatened birds, just to get an order of magnitude estimate of what might be required across all threatened taxa. And I've sort of put known in bold, because this is species that we know are threatened and have been assessed using these rigorous criteria. I mean, you know, an awful lot of species that are not yet known, an awful lot haven't been assessed. So this is just known threatened species. But yeah, approximately 5 million when you take into account all those other threatened species. So that was kind of our total. And then I guess the question is, 5 billion a lot? So I spent a lot of time giving this presentation to conservationists who don't really think about numbers that much, unless it's sort of bird population numbers. They don't really get sort of money. So, 5 billion, is that a lot of money? I mean, for critically endangered bird species, for example, you'd be looking at an investment of about 125 million a year, which is not a lot of money when you compare it to spending on other things that people spend money on. So total needs, 5 billion, about 10% of what the US consumers spend on pets every year, so pet food, pet accessories, etc. So it's not a lot of money when you, I mean, they're sort of trivial comparisons, but it gives you a sense of whether or not these are big amounts of money. And yeah, I mean, some of these stats are fairly ridiculous, really. Less than 50% of what we spend in Europe on ice cream in a summer. So not huge amounts of money. So that's the species side. Is everybody kind of with me?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So the other side of this, with the other key target we looked at, was protecting important sites for biodiversity. So I can't remember the exact wording of the target now. There it is. So conserve at least 17% of the terrestrial environment, especially areas of particular importance for biodiversity, through effectively and equitably managed systems of protected areas. So I can't remember exactly what the current coverage of protected areas is, but it's quite substantially below 17%. So protected areas are pretty key. So nature reserves, national parks, wilderness areas are pretty key when it comes to protecting nature. And so for this target, we wanted to look at how much it would cost to effectively manage existing protected areas. Many are not managed at all, they're sort of paper parks as they're managed in place. And also, how much would it cost to expand that network of sites to cover 17% of the global land area, and in particular, sites that are really important for biodiversity. So biodiversity is quite heterogeneous in terms of its distribution. So some really rich areas, some really poor areas. So some are better than others. So we started with important bird areas, which IBAs, which is what we call them, because again, we've got really good data for birds. And using a set of kind of fairly rigorous scientific criteria, the most important sites for birds around the globe, a network of important sites for birds around the globe, have already been identified as the key sites. If you lose these sites, you lose species. Basically, they're identified because they have significant populations of threatened or restricted range species, or hold very significant populations of those species. And we also found a rather convenient fact was that, so currently about half of IBAs are in existing protected areas. But conveniently, if you increase that to full protected coverage, you'd meet your 17% target quite easily. So that was sort of the benchmark we were aiming for. That would meet your 17% coverage target. As I said, more than half of IBAs are not currently protected. So that was sort of how we were going to cost the achievement of that target for sites. But we wanted to obviously look at important sites for all species, which is quite difficult again because there's not enough data. So people have used similar criteria to identify key sites for other taxa, and this has been systematically done in 12 other countries for mammals, amphibians, reptiles, and a small number of other groups of animals. And using information in those countries on the IBAs that also occur in those countries, we managed to work out that the majority of key biodiversity areas are also IBAs, and that they're kind of the overlap in terms of coverage is about 80%. So we're then able to use that relationship to scale up our estimates for IBAs to cover key biodiversity areas as well. So we started with looking at the recurrent costs of managing existing protected areas. So, I mean, it differs quite a bit between different countries. I mean, if you're talking about protected areas in Africa, you're talking about you need a lot of rangers to protect against poachers. If you're talking about protected areas in England, you need very different kinds of management to keep a site in good condition. So sort of very different kinds of management in different areas, but basically staff costs, recurrent operational costs, infrastructure costs, capital costs of actually maintaining a site in good condition. So in order to estimate these costs for important bird areas, how much does it cost to protect them effectively? We collected data for about 350 protected areas around the world that overlap with IBAs. I covered about 50 countries, so sort of a reasonable global spread. And using that data then models cost per hectare against the range of variables which tend to determine costs for site management, particularly area of the site, the size of the site, and then sort of various proxies for threats. So the population density around the site tends to be a good proxy for threats facing the site for a variety of reasons. And row density, different kinds of land cover tend to affect costs. And also, again, country-specific variables like GDP and human development, which tend to influence country-level costs. And this is just an example of, so all the black dots on this map are important bird areas identified around the globe, and the red dots are the ones we managed to get data for, so it's a reasonable spread across most continents, although there was only a handful in some places. And unsurprisingly, we found that big sites are more expensive to manage as a whole, but per hectare they're cheaper to manage because you get sort of economies of scale. You know, you only need one vehicle, you only need, you know, one member of staff, for example. But level of threat is quite important. So sites surrounded by quite high pressure in terms of human population density or road density tended to be more expensive to manage. And again, sites in richer countries tended to be more expensive to manage for obvious reasons. So based on that, we came up with costs for currently protected important bird areas of about 7 billion a year. All important bird areas of about another 7 billion a year, so about 14 in total. And extrapolating to all key biodiversity areas, you come up with a total of about 17, 18 billion a year for effectively managing sort of a coherent network of protected sites around the world. Majority of this is needed in higher income countries, even though the greatest area of threatened sites and sites needing protection is in lower income countries, primarily because it's cheaper to do conservation in those countries, and also there's less pressure on land in terms of population density, etc. The next step was then to look at, well, what are we spending now? How close are we to achieving that target? I mean, we kind of know that a lot of protected areas are not being managed effectively in the UK, let alone in, you know, some of the poorest regions of the world. So So we tried to come up with how much we were currently spending on protected area management. We managed to get data for, I think, about 500 or 1,000 sites, covering about 40% of the area currently designated as a protected area. And using those relationships between per hectare costs of what's required in some countries and per hectare costs of what's currently being spent, we came up with basically quite a significant shortfall, particularly in developing countries. So the bottom pie chart shows is probably under, these are in billions, probably under half a billion currently being spent on protected area management in developing countries, and probably an additional 2 to 3 billion required to actually effectively manage and expand the network of sites. So about a tripling of current expenditure required in developing countries. And in higher income countries, not such a big problem, but in many cases you need at least a 50% increase in funding to really ensure that the species that occur in those sites are being effectively protected. The last step, and this is the last bit of methods, I think, was to look at the cost of actually expanding the network of sites. So I've looked at the cost of managing currently protected sites, how much is currently being spent on them, but then the question of how would you expand this network of protected sites to cover currently unprotected areas, which is quite significant. So it's quite difficult to do because there's very different ways of protecting sites. So in some countries, you just need to buy the land, particularly in countries where you've got land being cleared for forestry, where logging rights have already been sold, so places in the Amazon, for example. The only solution available to conservation populations is to buy the logging rights and protect the land. In other countries, you can come to different agreements. It's obviously, in some countries, legislation is put in place saying you can't do anything with this land, it's now protected. But there are still indirect costs involved with that, because if you've got a farmer farming a piece of land, he makes, X dollars per year. If you say to him you can't do that, there's then that lost revenue, and often you have to pay compensation. So there's different ways of looking at this. So the simplest way, really, was to use this, probably the first ever globally available data set of land values, agricultural opportunity costs. So they're basically the profits from farming the land, because agriculture covers more than half the globe, particularly threatened sites. And then using that as a proxy for how much compensation you'd have to pay or what the purchase costs would be for that site. So as I said, it can be quite variable. It does depend on what the current ownership structures are, what the governance structures are. But sort of the best proxy available. And so this, actually, I'm coming up with the main chunk of the cost will actually be protecting these currently unprotected areas, because land is now a very scarce resource globally, with an expanding population, expanding, increasing consumption of, land-intensive goods like livestock products, etc. So about 50 billion annually would be required to protect those areas, the important areas for birds that are currently unprotected. So that would be sort of an annual compensation payment, if you like, for the foregone agricultural income that would have been obtained from that land. Much, much more expensive in high-income countries, more than double the cost in lower-income countries. And so you then come up with, if you like, a total site cost, combining the expanding the network costs, so expanding to cover 17.5% of the globe, combined with the management costs, so the annual costs effectively managing those sites for nature. This gives you a figure in the region of about 76 billion per year, which sounds like quite a lot of money. But is it a lot? Again, you look at, is this a big figure? So what I've done here, I've then combined that with the species costs, so the cost for protecting all globally threatened species by improving their conservation status by one red list category. You combine the two, taking into account some overlap in site management costs, and you come up with about 80 billion annually to meet these two targets by 2020, which may sound like a lot, but it's not actually really that much. It's about 0.1% of global GDP. It's even less if you consider the wealth of the top 1%, for example, because global wealth is much bigger than global GDP. GDP is a flow figure. So it's not necessarily a huge figure, so it's affordable, I guess, would be my take on our finding. But obviously current funding is totally insufficient. You need at least an order of magnitude increase in current funding, so by a factor of 10 to kind of have any chance of achieving these targets. But it's worth pointing out that money isn't everything. I mean, there's no guarantees that if you spend this much money, you'll achieve what you want to achieve, particularly for species, because there's a whole range of other factors that affect it. There's political factors, or corruption in some countries. There's a whole range of factors. So the money, if you like, is a necessary but not sufficient condition for actually achieving these objectives. So there's no guarantees, but certainly without that increase in funding, it's very unlikely that you will achieve those targets. This just sort of puts them in context. I quite like this figure. So I don't know if you can read it, but there's a tiny little green dot at the top, which is current spending on protected areas worldwide. And a slightly bigger green dot, which is the investment needed to achieve those two targets. And then compare that to a variety of other things. So we've got the size of the global economy, I think that's in 2011, so it's increased probably significantly since then. We've got subsidies for agriculture, so so these are billions, so you've got 252 billion going in subsidies to increase agricultural production on the one hand, to intensify agriculture, but on the other hand, you're going to have to pay money to actually buy back that land because it's been destroyed. So you've got governments paying for it, actually exactly opposite of what they need to do. But I mean, that's dwarfed by other things, global military spending, fossil fuel subsidies, another problem. We've got, you know, nearly $2 trillion being paid in subsidies to fossil fuel companies to extract more fossil fuels. So perverse subsidies, basically perverse because they're not delivering on public policy objectives very, very effectively. And that's just a summary of the results, which you probably don't want to see again. It's just some of the figures, quite a lot of figures in this talk. The real thing you need to remember is 80 billion, that's what's required. And we need an order of magnitude increase in funding. Less than 10% of needs being met for threatened species. So the results of this were released in 2012, just days before the next CBD meeting. So the Conventional Biological Diversity meets every 2 years. So in 2010 they agreed their targets. 2012 they were going to meet again to discuss financing options. So we tried to time the release of this paper for the week of that meeting to try to have some influence on the negotiations. So the paper was released days before, as I said, and got some media coverage, not a huge amount, but it's kind of, when you come up with headline figures, you know, newspapers quite like to talk about them. I think even the Daily Mail covered it. And the outcome of that meeting was actually quite positive. There were other inputs, there were other reasons, but developer countries agreed to do a target of doubling current funding by 2015 to support the achievement of those targets by 2020, which was, in the context, quite a big achievement because it's a constant battle when it comes to both climate change and biodiversity loss to work out who should pay, whether those who are responsible should pay, whether developed countries should support developing countries. There's quite a lot of wrangling, but essentially developing countries can't afford on their own to deal with these issues. They need some support. So quite good, but not brilliant, because in setting that target, they didn't pin down what their current baseline expenditure is, because nobody has a really good accurate estimate of what developed countries are currently spending. So there's no current spending estimate, so therefore there's no future target to hold them to account to, and they promised to double funding. So it's sort of very positive commitment, very nice words, but very difficult to track progress against that target. The next meeting occurred end of 2014. I, to be honest, haven't been following this process because my job is taking me elsewhere. But progress, mid-term review of progress towards achieving these targets hasn't been particularly positive. In general, we will fail to meet the 2020 targets based on current levels of funding and current levels of implementation. Pressure is building to do something, I think, on the back of some of this work and lots of other work that's going on. So the last bit of my talk is going to be about, well, why should we bother, I suppose. So when you talk to conservationists, they kind of know why you should bother. They think, well, we just should. But decision makers, governments don't always get that. They say, we've got other priorities, there's other things we need to spend money on. So I see it as two arguments. There's a moral case for protecting nature, and there's an economic case for protecting nature. So I'm an economist, and so the economic case is something I use quite strongly, but, you know, I love nature, that's why I work for the RSPB. I've got a cute picture here to support the moral case, which is basically that, you know, people think the environment is important, people think we should protect the environment, and there's huge support for action to prevent biodiversity loss. So I think there was a poll last week saying 40% of people said the single biggest issue that didn't get enough attention in the election debate was the environment. So there are people who want to hear more about the environment. Who care? So people see it as a real moral obligation. There's a very strong sense, and I think the RSPB's membership shows that lots of people in the UK care about nature. But there is also an economic case, which has increasingly been recognised in recent years, that protecting sites that are important to biodiversity, protecting nature, having a healthy natural environment, actually provides lots of benefits to people as well. So scientists call them ecosystem services, which is a phrase I really hate. But basically, there's lots of outputs from ecosystems that benefit people. You know, you can't produce food without a healthy natural environment, raw materials, timber. So then we call these provisioning services. The natural world provides us with physical raw materials, independent of the natural environment. There's also a range of kind of ecological processes within natural ecosystems. They help control flooding. So we had huge flooding in the Somerset levels last year. That's primarily down to bad ecosystem management. Farmers are being paid subsidies to dredge the Somerset levels. Dredging is not a sustainable solution to flooding the Somerset levels. It's called Somerset because it's, well, I can't remember the exact meaning of Somerset, but basically it's an area that is in a floodplain. It's designed to flood. If you work with nature, you could actually reduce flood risk. Increase habitat for birds, you lose a small amount of agricultural land, but the farming lobby in Somerset is huge. So they're now being paid even more subsidies to dredge even more frequently to prevent flooding like we had in Somerset in 2013. So an example of what can happen when you've got a strong farming lobby and a conservative government.
I think one thing that needs to be said about Somerset levels is that without the so to speak, artificial canalisation, you know, with the barrier banks on the watercourses, the whole area would periodically flood.
Periodically.
Quite naturally.
So you need, there's a combination of man-made and natural floodplains, yes, which can work together, essentially.
Yeah.
But there are some trade-offs in terms of agricultural output.
That's right, but if you want to have it ready for agriculture, you've got to keep water out of most of it nearly all the time.
Not entirely true, but anyway, I'm not a flood risk expert. So we've got a whole team of people who work on water policy, so it's not my area.
Okay.
But certainly some bad decisions, not necessarily working with the grain of the environment. And of course, nature. I mean, there's kind of a trade-off, or sort of an overlap between the moral value of nature and what economists call the cultural value of nature. So nature provides lots of benefits, some of which could be sort of quantified. Nature-based recreation, tourism, people are inspired by nature. People have tried to put monetary values on these things, which is actually quite difficult to do. People have come up with these huge estimates of the value of some of these services in terms of the extent to which they support human health and well-being, essentially. For example, in England, is that the costs of managing nature preserves are outweighed something like 9-1 by the societal benefits, or what's estimated to be the societal benefits. In reality, you can never come up with a total estimate of the value of nature because, of course, if there was no environment, there would be no people. So it's sort of...
Yeah, sorry to keep running it, but when you talk about societal benefits from a managed nature reserve, in what terms is that expressed?
How do you mean? Well, you can express it in pounds per year.
As ascertained according to what?
Well...
For instance, you could think in terms of numbers of visitors to nature reserves pay for entry.
Yeah, but what economists would say is that the price you pay for entry doesn't necessarily reflect the value you place on that visit, because actually the value you take from that visit may well exceed the price you pay.
I was just wondering where this estimated value actually comes from.
Sure. Maybe I'll come back to that at the end, because I could talk about that for a long time, sort of my area.
Yeah.
I'll come to the end, which I may actually really be at. And then, yes, that's just a quote from the UK government, published a review of sort of the value of our natural ecosystems, if you like, in 2011. It said some very, very positive things. So I quite like this quote from a government published paper, sort of sums up sort of some of the ways in which the natural environment underpins our prosperity and our sort of health and well-being. Brief conclusions. We can afford to save nature based on the cost estimates that we come up with here, but there's no guarantees of success. We cannot afford not to, both because, you know, we're facing a mass extinction crisis, essentially. The rates of extinction currently are such that we've never seen such high rates in all of human history. Low-income countries really need support from developed world countries, because, you know, partly because there's more threatened species, partly because they can't afford it themselves. But you know, either way, it's urgent, basically. We don't invest now, things will only get more difficult. It makes sense to invest early, save costs in the long run, maybe cut out things like some of the perverse subsidies, for example. And yeah, I should just say thanks. This was funded by the Cambridge Conservation Initiative, based in Cambridge, and it was a collaborative project with the University of Cambridge, so a number of the University of Cambridge conservation scientists involved, BirdLife, United Nations World Conservation Monitoring Centre, also in Cambridge, BirdLife International and the ICB. And that's it.
And congratulations to Donald for taking exactly 1 hour to finish. Very unusual.
So they normally too long or too short,
despite the interruptions. Anyway, I've done my bit. So yeah. Anybody else got any questions?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just taking what Ted said about the benefits. You know, I mean, I think you had a big bubble up at one point saying, you know, how much nature is worth to us. How much is that big bubble there dwarfs everything else?
Yes.
I've been trying to think about examples. I can think of a thing like bees, because with bees, you know, they pollinate, they're responsible for producing all the foodstuffs.
Yeah.
I could see it perhaps that worms, you know, in the soil, create soil again for growing food. I think having natural habitat, it's absolutely true. I mean, you do feel better for going, but I think there is a challenge in... sadly, we have to put a number on. I mean, it's demeaning in a way because it's a priceless thing. But you know, I mean, if you go to a park or perhaps to a wetlands area, you know, I find it a challenge to understand how to say how that benefits one in a number.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll follow up on that question then.
Yeah.
So it does sometimes sound a bit demeaning, particularly when you talk to people who are not familiar with it. It sounds demeaning, but it is the way policymakers now think, because when they have to make a decision on a new project, so I think that's why I put up the HS2 example. So HS2, there was a big debate about HS2, the high-speed rail link, as to whether the costs would outweigh the benefits. And so the government conducted a detailed cost-benefit analysis, and they came up with a 2-to-1 ratio, that benefits would outweigh the costs 2-to-1.
Somebody defines there what is meant by a benefit.
Yes.
And then quantifies it.
Well, there's government guidance on how cost-benefit analysis has to be carried out. Which is supposed to include environmental benefits.
But what actually, in concrete terms, constitutes a benefit depends on the nature of the thing.
Agreed. So my first point was just that I agree it can sound a bit sort of demeaning, but it's the way policymaking works.
Yes.
Because there's inevitably trade-offs, because, you know, we can't spend everything on nature, so there's a point at which you say, how much should we spend? How much is it worth? You tend to end up in these difficult situations. So different conservation organisations and different bodies see this differently. Some refuse to talk about economic benefits. They think it's demeaning. They think it undermines the moral case for conserving nature. The reality is, for 30 years, we've tried to argue that there's a moral case for saving nature. It's going down the pan. And so we're increasingly trying to talk to decision makers saying, actually, this provides a lot of other benefits that you're not recognising.
In other words, you talk money to the decision makers.
Well, particularly those in the Treasury. In terms of benefits, so there's a number of ways of defining them and a number of ways of quantifying them. So we tend to use this ecosystem service framework to define the benefits that nature provides. So if you've got a piece of natural habitat, you say, well, what benefits it is, what flow of benefits it is it providing each year? So if it's providing food, timber, other raw materials, there's already a market price for those goods. So it's pretty straightforward to work out. Sort of the benefit that's flowing from that piece of land. That's quite straightforward. When it comes to regulating services, so things like, an example of a regulating service would be the role that natural ecosystems play in storing and sequestering carbon from the atmosphere. So there's far more carbon locked up in natural habitats than there is in the atmosphere. And depending on what you do to your habitat, more carbon will come out and more carbon will be stored. So there is already a global carbon price, because currently there's an emissions trading system in the EU. So,
and of course, you could grow maize as biofuel.
You could do, yes. So in the EU,
which is then making a circle between agricultural industry and carbon storage.
Potentially, although growing maize, well, what's currently happening is people are growing maize and other biofuels on the peat soils of East Anglia.
Yes.
Which results in massive emissions of carbon dioxide. Because traditionally East Anglia was a huge wetland,
yes.
And wetlands store vast amounts of carbon. of growing maize on peat soils is completely perverse, which is why currently we're campaigning for the biofuels cap in Europe to be slashed. But that's a whole other story.
And of course you have cattle who give off methane, don't they, which isn't helpful. So if you had lamb that was used by cattle,
yes,
the slight downside is they produce, you know, this methane.
Yes, cattle do produce vast amounts of methane.
Yeah.
But so I guess we wouldn't be thinking about that when you're talking about a natural ecosystem, because cattle are not really quite of a natural ecosystem. If you like, if you've got a nature reserve, a protected area, you're going, how much carbon is it storing? We have a price because industrial emitters have to pay a price for every unit of carbon they emit in Europe. So you could say, well, the alternative to that is you've got all this carbon locked up in your nature reserve. If we convert it to agriculture and start growing food crops, for example, you'll lose all that carbon. It will all go up into the atmosphere.
So global warming would result, I think, in that use of carbon dioxide.
So carbon is an example. A lot of issues around water use. So various ways of putting a price. So an awful lot of water companies spend a huge amount of money purifying water because it picks up a lot of silt, a lot of dirt, etc. as it flows from the uplands downstream. If you manage the uplands in the right way, as they should be, so the uplands should be a combination of trees, thick vegetation, etc. The water is naturally cleaned. The water comes out downstream is clean. The water company doesn't have to pay any money to clean that water. So if you protect your natural habitat, clean water, the water company makes a saving, it's a cost saving, that's a benefit. That's another example. When it comes to there's lots of those around flood risk, defences again, how much money would it cost to build man-made flood defences? What if you just let nature provide the flood defences? So an example is often on the coast. So on the coast often what we'll do is we'll build big concrete walls. But actually, whether you like it or not, we've got sea level rising slightly. The sea's going to want to come in a bit. If you let the sea come in a bit, it's called managed realignment, and flood small areas of coastline, you get great wetland habitat for various and other wildlife. And you don't need any flood defences, because if you just build behind the flood defence...
It's like a sponge, isn't it?
It's just natural, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the classic example comes from East Asia, where traditionally you have huge mangrove forests around the coast, and mangrove forests are perfect defence from tidal surges and flooding. What's currently happening is about 90% of mangroves have been cleared for shrimp farming, primarily for the European market. Shrimp farms do not provide any flood defence to the vulnerable communities of Southeast Asia. So, another good example of a benefit. When it comes to some of the cultural benefits, which are slightly more difficult, there is, as I said, this overlap between what can be considered an economic benefit and what can be considered like a spiritual, moral... Because value has two different meanings. Value has a meaning in terms of what people believe is right and wrong, but value has a meaning in terms of how much something contributes to your well-being. If it contributes to your well-being, it's a benefit flowing from an ecosystem, which means you can put a monetary value on it. If it's a value which you hold as this is right, this is wrong, you can't put a price on that. So two different kinds of value. So for recreation, which is an example that was brought up, there's a number of different ways of doing it. Economists divide them into two different kinds of value. Use values, things you physically use. If you physically use something, you pay for it, it's very easy to work out a price for it. If it's a non-use value, so lots of people enjoy things purely because they exist or because they like the view, they don't really use them in any meaningful way. The only way to work out a price for that is quite literally to ask people, how much would you be willing to pay to protect this site?
It's like a utility.
Well, it's a utility function.
It's
a method called contingent valuation. You give people a range of scenarios, what could happen to this site, how much your taxes might go up if you want to protect this site from development or from X or Y or Z, and you come up with fairly statistically robust estimates of how much people would be willing to pay out of their own pocket to protect the site, to give you a lower bound estimate of what it's worth to them. And economics is not just about monetary values in markets, it's actually about well-being. Economics is about maximising human well-being, it's not just about maximising monetary value. So if you can work out how much something is worth to people, then you can say to the government, it's worth you investing in this, because the citizens in your country care about it, and they care about it this much, and you can trade that off against other values. So,
An interesting point underlying what you just said. You can ask, for instance, me, how much I would be willing to pay to protect the view from my bedroom window, which is in fact fine, lovely view. Given the money I have at my disposal, you could possibly push me up to £1,000 one-off payment, which would go nowhere if somebody wanted to obliterate that view for some development of
another. Mm-hmm. It would take many thousands of quids to counteract a serious pressure to destroy that view, which links in with your linked tax, that you're somehow asking me to imagine how much I would want everybody to pay to protect that view. Because I can't afford it. It would take lots and lots of people to afford the necessary money. So I had to kind of extrapolate over a population that I don't actually know the size of. So it's difficult for me to actually judge what, I would only offer to pay what I thought would achieve. It's no good for me paying money if it's not going to do anything. So I would have to be thinking in terms of how much money would a certain number of people need to pay to have a reasonable assurance of saving that thing, saving that benefit.
Well, essentially when you're trying to elicit these values, it comes down to how you design your questionnaires and how you design
your
different scenarios.
But this is perhaps what I'm driving at. How do you actually put it to people? Because they have to understand all of these interlinking factors.
Not necessarily. I don't necessarily agree they have to recite all the factors, I think. I'll just briefly mention one or two other...
So, if for instance, you came to my front door and asked me that question, I said, OK, 500 quid. So you write down 500 quid. But that's not going to be the only 500 quid.
No, of course not. No, you would have to... You would have to aggregate it over the relevant population. Yeah.
So... Unless you asked everybody, you're using some sort of sampling.
Yes, of course, yeah.
And then applying it across the population, even to people who don't enjoy that particular benefit.
Well, that's one of the challenges, because this is what some critics would argue, is that, well, everybody cares about every bit of nature, and everybody would be willing to pay something to save it. So, it does get challenging. And there was a really high-profile court case in the US in the 1980s, which is when some of these valuation techniques started to be used. There was a huge oil spill, huge massive oil spill, and it was argued that the company would have to pay compensation to everybody who were damaged, who were damaged by this. But then, initially they were just restricting the compensation to local people. We had people right down other end of the US saying, but I care about that site, I deserve compensation. So, it comes down to some sort of a moral question about who deserves, who owns it, who has the right to it. I'll just mention one of the other techniques we use for those sorts of things, particularly views, is you can look at house price data. And if you look at this huge database of national house price data, and you can see how much in addition. So once you control for factors like the size of the house, the number of bedrooms, you can look at, well, how much extra do people pay to live close to a national park, to have a nice view, to have a view of water. And it's quite a significant chunk of money that people spend extra on houses to have nice views, and you can use that as a rough, usually lower bound estimate. But it's worth saying, although these are all lower bound estimates, generally the results that come out is that the benefits are massive compared to the cost of protecting these things, protecting and managing them. So, there's another question.
It's more a point I want to make. It's going off on a tangent a little bit, but it's a good example of how the public suddenly wake up to something natural that's been taken away. And that was when the old government now were going to sell off the Forestry Commission and all our open spaces that we were very much cherishing at the time were potentially going to disappear to private landowners. It must have been a big wake-up call to the government at that stage that millions of people voiced their concerns and they had to do a U-turn.
Very much so. Yeah. What's more of a problem is the incremental losses that happen every day, every time a planning decision is made that goes the wrong way. So I don't know how many of you will have heard, for example, that there's currently a huge battle for us is a site in Lodge Hill in Kent, which has the largest population of nightingales. How many of you ever heard a nightingale? Never seen terrible. Have any of you ever heard a nightingale? Good few. So yeah, I quite like nightingales. They're incredible. They migrate from Africa. They declined by like 50-60% over the last 15-20 years. don't know the figures because I'm a very counter person, I'm a money counter person, but largest population of nightingales in the UK occurs on this site, Lodge Hill, in Kent. Unfortunately, it's currently owned by the Ministry of Defence. They want to sell it off for housing development. The local council have granted them the application in contravention of all the national planning policy guidelines. But how many of you heard about it? We've been trying to make a big campaign again about it, trying to get lots of people to sign a petition to say please don't sell off this site. It goes against planning guidance, sets a dangerous precedent for the destruction of protected sites. So it has all the levels of protection you can expect for a site. There's no way it should be developed. Incredibly important. It will almost certainly be developed, but nobody hears about it. So yes, the forest example was great, but these little losses, this is why things are declining. These little losses happen all the time, and it's very difficult to fight every single one of them. But yeah, the forestry one clearly showed how much people do care. The government really shot themselves in the foot with that one. And as a result, forest policy has been certainly less bad than it was for this government.
I think they've messed around with the planning, haven't they, the council, and I think they've made it easier for the builders to build. I think there's been changes, isn't there?
Yes, there's a new, well, there's a new national planning policy framework, and in it there's a principle which says that for every planning application there should be a presumption in favour of sustainable development. Yeah. So they included the word sustainable after a lot of lobbying from bodies like ourselves that didn't actually...
Depends what you mean by sustainable.
Didn't actually define what's meant by sustainable. So far, there has been a parliamentary inquiry into it. So far, sustainable development has just meant sustainable economic development, i.e. development.
It will retain its value.
Yes.
I'd like to make a sort of general comment there now that the word sustainable has been introduced, because when that first began to slip into official speak, which was around 1990, became prevalent. It was derived from what was essentially an ecological meaning, as in a sustainable fishery or sustainable forestry. In other words, that you exploited the resource only to the extent that it could sustain. So a sustainable fishery was one which you exploited to the extent that it did not die down and maintained itself. And that good quality of sustainability got translated into things like housing development. Whereas, as if, you know, because it was a good quality term, a desirable quality, will transplant it into housing developments. So a sustainable housing development then becomes like a sustainable fishery. It's a good thing. And that was, I think, the original, as it were, hypocrisy of the introduction of the word sustainable. And it has sustained its meaning or non-meaning throughout. I mean, even planning applications now still use the word sustainable.
Yes, the word sustainable, it depends how you define it.
Yes.
Economists used to define it, or, well, the official UN definition initially was that sustainable development is development that allows the present to meet its needs without putting it at risk the ability of future generations to meet their own needs.
Yeah.
That was the original definition of sustainable.
Yeah, which sort of fits
UN.
In with the other.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not doing damage to the long-term
health, yes, exactly, yeah.
Whereas,
well, so for example, in the case of that housing development, you would say, well, if we want a sustained or a sustainable population of nightingales in the UK, they're currently declining precipitously, so therefore, almost certainly, I mean, it can get quite difficult to define exactly what sustainable is. If you've got a precipitously declining population, destroying the most valuable site for them is probably not sustainable.
Yes.
But the less difficult.
The nightingales.
Yeah. Not sustainable for nightingales, whether it's sustainable for us is another question.
There was another question which was sort of slipped in and slipped out again. There are different kinds of operation involved in, as it were, restoring an environment and its populations of species. You talked a lot about birds.
which for the most part are very migratory.
I wouldn't say for the most part.
Well, they can move around.
Well, they're mobile.
They're mobile. And there's not a lot of restriction on where they can go. Now there are others. So when you're restoring an environment, you can think in terms of changing the base of the environment, like what grows there, how much water there is, how many trees there are, and all that sort of thing. As it were, the rooted in part of it. And then there are those creatures which are not, so to speak, rooted into the environment, but which can come in or be introduced or reintroduced. So one could say where birds of a certain species have disappeared, you could restore the kind of vegetation that they like to live in, and then go and catch birds from some other place and release them.
Assuming they still exist at that other place.
I mean, but you have, for instance, birds which are disappearing from South East England, which are still fairly frequent.
Well, the issue with reintroduction is there's no point reintroducing them if you haven't tackled the cause of their decline.
Yes,
tackle
the intrinsic cause of their decline,
sure.
the degradation of the environment, and then you can introduce them. But now this especially applies, say, to fish, which appeared briefly.
Yes, I probably should have said this didn't come in the marine environment.
Yeah, or the freshwater.
I didn't actually explicitly mention that.
Or the freshwater environment.
Well, indirectly. Yeah. Indirectly, but we didn't cover the marine environment because that's a very different setup.
Yeah, but there's an awful lot to do with maintaining healthy fish populations. And one of the issues is that the water environments that the fish live in, some of them are interconnected, so fish, at least a certain species, can move from one to another. And others, like lakes, are not interconnected. And the only way a fish species can move from one to the other is, for instance, by fish eggs being transplanted on birds' legs from one lake to another lake. So, for instance, you get divergent dichotomous races of so-called whitefish in the Cumberland Lakes. There are several different Cumberland Lakes with very closely related, have been identified as fish species, but they're so close, so similar, you might call them races. And each one lives in a different lake.
Yeah.
So, if something happened in one particular lake and that species was wiped out, say, by evolution event, you might have difficulty restoring precisely that particular species or race. So if you wanted to repopulate it, you'd probably have to take fish from another one of the lakes, even though it's somewhat of the wrong sort. But, you know, all of this would be part of restoring.
So, I mean, reintroduction programs...
Sorry?
Reintroduction programs are one of many actions that tend to be required.
Yes, well, this is basically what I was trying to sort of lead up to.
So, red pikes were reintroduced. So, red pikes were lost entirely from... They were shot to extinction in Ireland, and they were lost from England and most of Scotland, and there was a tiny population left in Wales.
What about ospreys? I'm not sure about ospreys.
They've recolonised naturally.
They recolonised.
As far as I'm aware. Various mechanisms have been put in place to try and encourage them more to arrive and to encourage them to breed, so providing nesting habitat, that sort of thing. But red kites are an example of it. So that they could have recolonised naturally into England, but it would have taken a very long time. So kind of seed populations were reintroduced around England, and they're now, I mean, they're not as common as they would have been in the 1700s, but there's, I think there's a couple of thousand breeding pairs now, so substantially above what they were down to, which was just a handful. Reintroductions are useful for some species, but we can't reintroduce nightingales, because nightingales are not migratory species, they come from Africa. You know, you can't reintroduce nightingales. They're declining because their habitat's gone.
Yeah. And they're also, I mean, you have seasonally migrating birds.
Yeah.
Which nest in one place and spend the rest of the year in some other place, maybe thousands of miles away. And you'd have to sort of regulate both ends.
Well, it's exactly what, yes, you do have to do. I mean, so for migratory birds, one of the challenges is a lot of them get shot in the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
One of the problems is a lot of them get shot in the Mediterranean on their way. Yeah, that's one example. We've recently discovered that Britishly owned airspace or territory on Malta, so the British big base, it's actually one of the areas where an awful lot of birds get shot illegally by Maltese hunters, but it's because the UK are not adequately patrolling their own base. So the reason we identify that is because we work to lobby the UK government. There's only so much we can do to influence the Maltese government.
Oh yeah.
But yes, yeah, migratory birds are a particular challenge.
Yeah. Any more? Well, clearly this could go on almost forever, so we perhaps better let them off the